What's cracking, folks? I'm Jared Dubin, and this is Quo Vadimus. We are returning to the usual Friday podcast. This week, Seth Partnow, editor of Nylon Calculus, on the line. Seth, what's up, man?
How's it going?
Pretty good, pretty good. We actually got two decent games, I think, for the first time all season. You know, one of the second game, I guess, looked like it wasn't going to be that great, but then there was a big comeback, so it wound up being fairly entertaining. And the first game was close for most of the night as well. And I think this is a first for us on the podcast.
Yeah, and it's funny, the I guess not funny, but you wouldn't have suspected that with the starting lineup that New Orleans was forced to put out there, that this game would be really that competitive at all.
And then I think after the game, one of the guys that was in that starting lineup, it came out that he fractured his wrist and he's done. Bryce DeJean Jones, I think is his name.
Yeah, he didn't start last night. I mean, because that had happened before the game.
Right.
They had to start, I mean, depending on, you know, how you want to assign positions, they'd start Alonzo G at shooting guard, which, you know, aside from Anthony Davis, Norris Cole, Alonzo G, Dante Cunningham, and Alexis Ejinsa, that has a legitimate claim to be a D-League starting lineup.
They gave, 31 minutes to Tony Douglas, Kendrick Perkins, and Luke Babbitt.
Yeah. But, so, you know, good on the Pellies for, you know, continuing to play hard. I mean, obviously Anthony Davis has about 25 million reasons to
I think it's 23 ball every night. I've seen it's an extra $23 million or so dollars if he makes an All-NBA team because of his Rose Rule contract.
And for those who don't know, it's basically a player coming off of his fourth season in the league is eligible to make up to 25% of the salary cap unless they qualify for the so-called Rose Rule, which there are, you know, you have to either be MVP or get voted to two all-star game starting lineups or make two all-NBA teams in your first 4 years. Right. And it can't be one starter, one all-NBA team. It has to be one of those in its entirety. And so,
Davis was all-NBA last year, so if he makes it again this year, he's eligible. If he doesn't, then his contract goes back down to a regular style 25% max.
Yeah, which this is actually kind of an interesting question. Is a situation like this, if there's a way to, it's probably not allowed in the current CBA, but maybe something to look forward to in the kind of the next one, is a situation like this. You know, I think that everyone, when he signed that the full 5 year max, was anticipating it being the full 5 year Rose Rule max, and maybe there being some kind of ability to put a conditional in there that it changes to a 1-1 or something if he doesn't qualify for the Rose Rule.
I would imagine that teams would not want anything like that in the CBA.
I can imagine that, but it's a situation where I feel like it would come up pretty rarely, because it would only come up in situations where a guy is going to get extended before his fourth season really starts and is already, you know, basically the only player you can really see it be affecting right now is, say, Karl Anthony Towns. He starts the All-Star game his third year, and going into his fourth year, the Wolves want to extend him. I think everyone doing that is assuming that he's a 30% max player, and just maybe being able to build just that little bit in to protect the player. If everything works out, yes, I'm here for the full 5 years, but I don't want to. I don't want to get screwed if something happens. Say I break my wrist the first week of the season or something like that.
No, I understand. So, I just don't think that any team would agree to that or that the owners would even agree to put that option in there.
Maybe. It's just, it's worth, something worth highlighting.
It's, I think it's such a small pool of candidates, like you said, would even qualify for it, that I don't think it's something the players would even think to bring up.
Well, I mean, they're bringing up the individual, there's noises all over the place about the individual max being on the table, and that's a pretty small portion of players that affects that at the expense of everyone else.
Sure, but it's a small portion of players that all happen to be in charge of the NBPA now.
Yeah, I know.
When you have Chris Paul as the president, LeBron and Carmelo as vice presidents, like, that's something that's going to be important.
You and your political realities.
Yeah, well, you know.
Yes. Yeah. All right, sorry.
Anyway.
Yeah.
So Oklahoma City's defense in this game, again, came up as an issue. They gave up 123 points to a Pelicans team that is not great offensively. 129.3 offensive rating for the Pelicans in the game, which is fairly insane. OKC's defense now is, I think, outside the top 10. 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12. 13th in the league now and falling. It was at 10th as recently as like a month or so ago. They have allowed, since January 1st, 105.1 points per 100 possessions, firmly in the bottom half of the league. How big of a problem is this for them? I think it's, you know,
it's definitely a problem. I think to some degree, like the you know, giving the 100 and whatever, you know, giving up 130 offensive rating last night probably overstates the issue a little bit. The Pelicans were 12 of 20 from three.
But just as an example, it's the defense is even worse since the beginning of February, 109.3.
Yeah, but the point is even if they're leaving them wide open every time, nobody's shooting 60% from three for the rest of the year, so it's a little bit worse than it looks. On the other hand, they also did give actually the point to finish up there is they gave up 23s, which isn't a huge number, you know, in a game played at that pace. So a little bit it was good shot making by the Pelicans. I mean, if you know, Dante Cunningham is going 2 for 2 from three, and you know, just looking down the
Tony
list,
Douglas, like if Cole hit two threes,
yeah, right. No, you know, if
I mean, yes,
Norris Cole, Dante Cunningham,
game,
and Tony Douglas are going to go 6 of 8 combined from three, like. At some point, okay, maybe that wasn't great defense, but that's also it's fair to say there's a little bit of bad luck, for lack of a better term, built in there. But on the same time, they have 14 offensive rebounds, which is not great. You know, it's and didn't do a great job forcing turnovers, so.
Yeah, and it's also, you know, while this one game may not be representative of exactly how bad their defense has been bad for a while now. So it's not like this is totally out of left field. You know, they've been giving up a lot of points to a lot of teams. You know, Westbrook has talked about their defense needs to get better. Donovan has talked about their defense needs to get better. I mean, everybody knows their defense needs to get better. I'm just not sure where that comes from, other than guys just playing better. I mean, I guess Robertson is back now, so that should theoretically help a little bit. You know, even though Donovan, for some reason, thinks that Deion Waiters is a really good defender, he said the other day.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure how they
maybe
get,
if he's comparing him to Anthony Morrow. That's why he thinks so. I mean, his other kind of wing option off the bench. You look at who the Thunder are bringing off the bench, getting the majority of their bench minutes last night. It's Kyle Singler, Enes Kanter, Deion Waiters, and Randy Foy. That is a flammable defensive group, especially if you're doing things like playing like the three perimeter, like any combination of them really is worrisome. So I think it's probably a bit personnel. surprising that a team starting Steven Adams and Serge Ibaka at the big positions would be struggling so much on defense too. Just because that should be at very least a solid defensive team, especially with kind of a designated defensive player like Robertson. And you know, KD is, you know, not always the best defender, but he's mobile and 7 feet tall.
Right, and even Westbrook, you know, jumps himself out of position all the time, but it's not like he's bad. But then again, you know, that group of five guys in 533 minutes this year has a defensive rating that would lead the league by more than a few points. It's basically every other lineup that's been bad.
And that's, I guess, not surprising when you kind of dig into the guys. I mean, it's the same thing we seem to talk about every time we talk about Oklahoma City is these lack of two-way players. And again, you look at those guys getting the bench minutes I mentioned, those are all pretty much one-way offensive players. Kyle Singler has flirted with being a reasonable defender at points in his career, but given his kind of level of play since getting to Oklahoma City,
He's flirted more with being a zero-way player than a two-way player since coming to Oklahoma City.
Yeah, that's the harsh but fair way of putting it.
Right, and it's, you know, it's just the reality. You know, he was a good player and made sense as a guy they would target at the time they targeted him. Or I guess not really targeted, they just sort of were doing it to get Cantor and get rid of Jackson, I guess.
Yeah.
I
like that as a pickup for them at the time, and it just hasn't worked out at all.
Right. That's, you know, that's where I'm at, too. I guess, you know, connected to that issue, you know, they have finally started staggering the minutes for Russ and KD lately. You know, Durant has been in to start fourth quarters, I think the last two or three games. This is something that we've been talking about, you know, the few times that OKC has played on Thursday night that we've been doing this podcast. We've talked about it each time. We have been talking about it, you know, just in the universal we for years when Scott Brooks would basically refuse to stagger their minutes and would go 4 or 5 minute stretches with Russ, KD, and Ibaka all on the bench. And that is something that Donovan was doing for most of this season, too, at the start of the fourth quarter. They, you know, we'll see if they keep it up the rest of the way. And, you know, based on what Donovan said about it, it seems like they will be, you know, because he said he talked to KD about playing at that time of the game and that that's how they were going to do it. But I think we can all agree it's a good idea.
It's a good idea. I think it's one of those things that's probably it's a closer decision than is you know, commonly acknowledged. I think, I mean, you, with two stars, you get some synergies, and maybe it's worth punting some minutes for that, even though those might be ugly. I think specifically for Oklahoma City, given their complete dearth of kind of shot creators aside from those two, I think it is clearly a good decision. You know, when and if Blake Griffin gets healthy, it's a different decision for the Clippers, for example, whether or not, you know, that version of Blake Griffin can actually support an offense on his own, or if it actually makes sense to maximize his value by pairing him with Paul. That's an empirical question rather than a theoretical one. But it's still, I agree with you that it's at least good to see them trying it and seeing if they like it and if the players will accept it too. I think that's a hidden part to this. I mean, you know, especially given kind of the contract statuses, that is due some deference. But if Donovan is actually convincing them to try this, then that's a good sign, I guess.
I mean, there's no rule that they can't still play together. They're obviously going to play together at the start and end of each half.
Well, no, but you know, it really just depends on how much, you know, the synergy of the two of them together versus the drop off with neither of them on the floor versus the how much one or the other keeps them afloat. It's you know, mathematically, it's entirely possible that, you know, putting zeros out there for 8 minutes a game and putting both of them out there for 40 minutes a game is net better than, you know, them only playing together for 24 minutes but always having at least one on the floor or something like that.
Just as an example, so they played this season 543 minutes without either one of them on the court from NBA Wowie, which is the site that tracks all kinds of this stuff. They were outscored by 8.6 points per 100 possessions in those 543 minutes. So you look at it, on the season, Oklahoma City is, let's see, they're plus 7.4 points per 100 possessions. And in the 543 minutes they played without those two, they're minus 8.6. Like, that is a gigantic gap. It's like a worse than the Sixers gap.
Sure, no, but the point I'm making is it's possible that, you know, their overall performance... Now, I wouldn't make that argument for Oklahoma City, but just in broad terms, it could be that if they staggered more, that the lineups with only one of the stars would be less effective enough to the point where their overall net rating would be in the, you know, the fives or sixes or something like that. It's, like I said, it's an empirical question as far as how effective, like, those one-star lineups are versus the two-star lineups versus the no-star lineups. So, I've messed around with the numbers in the past, and you have to make some assumptions that, you know, won't hold up, and it probably makes a difference, but it's a win and or two, maybe a season worth of a difference, not like, you know, a sea change.
No, I agree with that, but I think it also makes a difference the timing of when they were doing it. They were doing it at the start of the fourth quarter, and that's a situation where if you're leading to go into the fourth quarter, all of a sudden your lead might be gone. If you're trailing, all of a sudden you're down by double digits by the time they come in.
Yeah, and that's actually the bigger problem is, especially in a playoff series, if the opposing team, and this is something that, if you remember, we talked about this when they played the Cavs earlier, if you're playing against a team that knows you're going to not stagger, then they can do something like the Cavs did in that game where they started the fourth quarter with, you know, a LeBron Kevin Love lineup against an all bench lineup for OKC, and that's just a disaster. And if you're not preparing to stagger, then you're in a situation where either you have to play guys, you know, 15 minutes straight, give up huge kind of lineup disadvantages. So that's why I think, especially in the case of Oklahoma City, it's smart, no matter, just in terms of being unexploitable, almost regardless of what the math says.
Right. So I do have some numbers right here that I want to run by you on KD and Russ. The first is from Justin Kubacko, who he does stuff for StatMuse now. I believe he was one of the first people involved with Basketball Reference.
Yes.
So this one is, Durant and Westbrook have scored 30-plus points in the same game 34 times, tied for second all-time with Oscar Robertson and Jack Twyman. First place is Elgin Baylor and Jerry West with 77 times. Now, first of all, that they're already in second place, you know, 9 years into KD's career, 8 years into Russ's career, is fairly ridiculous. If they do stay together on the same team, I would imagine they will give Baylor and West a run for their money, you know, over the next 10 years or so. But it's just ridiculous that they've scored 30-plus points in the same game that many times.
I'm just glad that we could mention Oscar Robertson's name in a way that didn't involve pointing to him being sort of a fuddy-duddy about the Warriors. But anyway, to be honest, I think that stat, in a way, demonstrates kind of the failure of them to put sufficient other offensive talent around them. Because part of the reason that happens is they're both great players, but they also, I mean, every game, both of them are going to take so many shots because who else is going to?
Yeah.
And that, you know, consistently, like, who is there, you know, it's to the point where we were wondering if, at the start of this season, if Deion Waiters or Enes Kanter could be that third offensive threat for them. Those were legitimate questions about, you know, that might help them, which, you know, kind of tells you where you are a little bit.
Right. So the other number that I wanted to run by you, I guess it's a series of numbers. This is from ESPN Stats and Information. So the Westbrook and Durant, when they're both in the lineup this season, the Thunder are 9-9 in games where they both score 25 points. 14-4, or 25 or more, obviously. 14-4 when only Durant scores 25 or more and Westbrook is under 25. 4-0 when only Westbrook scores over 25 and Durant is under. And 11-0 when they're both under 25. So, basically, they are 23-13 when Durant scores 25-plus points. Am I doing that math right? Yeah, 23-13. And then 15-0 when he scores under 25, which I think is just very interesting.
In games they both play. Yeah, I think that's to some degree a statistical artifact.
I'm not saying it means anything. I just found it interesting.
I think it is demonstrable of what I was just talking about is in games where they are getting stuff from other people, they're more effective. And this is the part where some people like rail about their offense, and it's the part where I point to their personnel and say, well, who else should be taking the shots to get them those points? And, you know, they don't have a lot of guys who can get their own shots or are exactly easy guys to get shots for who see playing time for them.
And KD himself made a similar point earlier in the season when he's like, you know, we're not the Spurs, we're not the Warriors. Like, that style of offense isn't going to work for us. And we've talked about that before, too. You know, if the ball is winding up in Andre Robertson's hands, you know.
You have to pick him up at half court.
Three or four times on a single possession, that's not an ideal situation for them. Whereas in Golden State, you don't care if the ball ends up in Harrison Barnes' hands three or four times in one possession.
I mean, you don't care if it ends up in Andrew Bogut's hands. I mean, I don't know how much of that game you saw, but you know, the start of that game was basically Andrew Bogut throwing backdoor passes.
Right.
All the time.
Oladipo was playing way up on Curry, so he started going backdoor, and then that opened up a million threes, and he's just insane.
Yeah, and so, you know, first of all, well, that's why you don't pick him up at half court. Second of all, that's the kind of complementary offensive talent that it's the horse is dead and gone, but I'm still going to beat on it. That it's the kind of complementary offensive talent that Oklahoma City just doesn't have.
Right. I'm going to report you for horse abuse.
Well, oh well. Between that and Zach LaVine being a shooting guard, it's not a point guard. There's plenty to report me for.
You've talked about that before? I mean, I don't think I've ever heard you talk about that.
Never. Well, anyway. It's because the Wolves never play on Thursdays.
That's true. Anyway, let's move on to game number two of the night. The Rockets came back. Not exactly sure what the largest deficit was.
21. I think there was a 21-point game at some point early in the third, I believe.
Yeah, which was about when I checked out and stopped paying attention. And then all of a sudden I see they're coming back and flipped. Didn't catch the whole end, but part of it at least. Obviously, a big-time collapse from Portland. And just at the time when they were getting a whole lot of love from all kinds of people for their play lately and for the fact that, you know, they have staved off what I think pretty much everybody assumed was going to be a precipitous drop for them this season, but, you know, they're over 500, they're in the playoff race. Look like they probably, I would say at this point, will get in. It's a bad loss for them to take.
Yeah. And it's you know, it's funny because Houston actually, like, turned up their defensive intensity a little bit. I think the big switch was they put some size on Lillard and McCollum, and the Portland didn't really adjust to that well. You know, they made it hard for the two guards to get the ball, and then Lillard especially went fairly egregious hero ball mode, kind of the last bit of the game, and I think that it's fairly egregious when he's missing all those shots, so I think that's probably harsh of me, but he went very, you know, I put it on my back and didn't really, wasn't able to convert all that often, and they didn't really have anywhere else to go for offense, and that, you know, was a big thing that enabled Houston to, you know, play some defense, play downhill on offense a fair amount, and then, you know, Harden, who I think looks like he's in maybe a little bit better shape than he was earlier in the year. Just, you know, you hate to do the you know, be the body composition whisperer based on what you're watching on TV, but he looks trimmer than he did at the very beginning of the season, and so maybe that helped some. But he was dominant offensively, you know, the entire second half.
Yeah, he wound up with 46 points, 5 rebounds, 8 assists for the game. Houston in the first half gave up 64 points, only 41 in the second half. Outscored them 70-41 in the second half, which is fairly absurd. I definitely agree on Harden looking like he's in better shape. He's definitely playing much better at this point now than he did early on in the season. Like, I don't think there's anyone that could in their right mind object to that. He is again now up to the league lead in minutes, in field goals, in free throw attempts, in free throws made. I'm looking at it here. Through, let's say, the end of December, he was at 28 points a game, 6 rebounds, 6.8 assists, but shooting 41% from the field, 34% from 3. And then since the new year started, he is still at 28.8 points per game, 6.8 rebounds, 7.3 assists, so ticked up both of those, and 46% from the field, 36% from 3. So shooting much better. I think he's getting to the line a little bit more as well. You know, the evidence is all there that he's playing better, and I think, you know, you can see that he's moving better. He looks trimmer, like you said. He's not necessarily at the level he was last year in terms of being, you know, one of the top 2 or 3 MVP candidates, but, you know, people were dogging him pretty hard at the start of the year, and I think that we can sort of let go of that at this point.
Yeah, and you talk about moving better, and one of the things that was noticeable kind of from the end of last year towards this year is, you know, the numbers were similar, but if you were really watching, you know, he just wasn't really getting, you know, exploding past people, getting separation nearly as often this year as he was last year, and that's kind of starting to come back again. Now, again, Portland, you know, none of their guards are exactly defensive masterminds, so it's maybe not the perfect view, but just that burst seems like it's there a little bit more than it was at the start of the season. And that's a big deal considering, you know, how much of their offense is based on him, you know, drawing second and third defenders. And at the same time, though, he's also probably benefiting. Like last night, Pat Beverly, you know, made every shot basically, and that also kind of helps both to give him kind of an outlet with the ball, and to maybe even slow down the help from coming just a touch.
Right. Do we want to talk about the report that he requested that Kevin McHale be fired, and then requested that Dwight Howard get traded?
I mean, you brought it up. Who knows? I mean, you know, reports. Somebody's agent said something to make someone else look good or bad. That's kind of when these reports come out. That's kind of my default position, especially if something like this, like there's, I can't imagine why anyone with the Rockets would put that out there.
I mean, if you replace league sources in the report with like Dwight Howard's agent, I think it would make
right.
a good deal of sense.
Right.
So,
You know, I don't think it doesn't seem like it's not hard at all to believe that Harden and McHale weren't simpatico, and you know, if he says, hey, I'd prefer someone else, I think that was fine when LeBron does it. I think it's fine when James Harden does it. It's on the organization to decide, you know, as I go hockey player there, the organization to decide.
Well, you are basically Canadian, so you can say
well,
organization,
you know,
like that.
to decide whether or not that's, you know, they agree or it's worth kind of going with the demands. And, you know, the power dynamics in Houston are probably different than those in Cleveland, where, you know, if LeBron has less to do, I think, in terms of convincing people. But I don't think that they needed to, you know, especially given how clearly kind of frustrated and angry McHale was at the level of effort and stuff like that at the start of the year. I don't think they needed a strong push. The more damning part of that is the "hey, trade this guy" part of it, I think. And you know, who knows whether that's true or not? I don't. Who, you know?
Well, if we take vines that loop 6 seconds of game action to be definitive, like James Harden and Dwight Howard hate each other. There was something the other night. They were both playing well. This was not last night. It was earlier in the week. They were both playing well, and they ran a pick and roll, and Harden threw an alley-oop like over Dwight's head that Dwight wasn't really looking for, and they started pointing at each other like, oh, why didn't you look? Like, oh, why didn't you shoot it? And somebody looped that vine, and it was like, looks like things are going super well with James and Dwight. And I was like, they're both playing well in this game. Like, this is not at all representative of what's happening here.
And Dwight has never been has always been kind of a bad body language guy. So it's not,
and
you
James
know,
has been a bad body guy.
What's that?
I said, and James Harden's been a bad body guy for most of this season.
Yeah, and so that's a, you know, singling that out as something specific is, I don't know. You know, you see it all the time. You saw, you know, you saw from the Milwaukee's game last night, Greg Monroe and Chris Middleton got into it at the start of a timeout, and that it seems like that that happens over the course of a season. Of
I'm sure that will wind up just as big a story as
the four seconds. Almost certainly not. But the point is, like, you know, if people are being, I'd rather. This isn't speaking to whether Harden did or did not, you know, demand Dwight be traded, but I think I'd rather my team that occasionally had blow-ups and argument than never did, because at least that's, you know, people, there has to be some degree of investment for the people to care that much to actually, like, you know, have a spat about it, you know what I mean? It's not a good thing, but it's probably healthy if it happens occasionally. Now, again, whether or not Howard and Harden are best of buddies, I would, you know, knock me over with a feather to learn that they aren't. But there's a jump from there between that and, hey, get this guy out of here.
Are you in the they should have gotten whatever they could for Dwight at the trade deadline camp?
No, because, like, what could they, like, he's good enough still, and that it's not just get him off the books or you know, it's not a situation where, if, like, say in New Orleans with Ryan Anderson, if they could have traded him basically for free, you know, for a fictional second and a TPE, then maybe that would have been good for them. I don't think that Dwight is as ugly as his next contract might be. I don't think he's a guy you give away like that.
I mean, I think that based on the way Morey has operated, he doesn't seem like he's going to be the guy to give Dwight that next contract, though.
That, that's not something that would be, you know, a positive value for them. So I would think that if you're not going to give the guy his next contract, you might as well take what you can get.
Sure, although, I mean, I also imagine that there'll be some way to, even if someone is just signing him, that there'll be a way to engineer it so that they at least get, like, a TPE out of it or something like that. So, yeah, I mean, it's not... there is value to be had in having him on your team for the rest of the season, and that matters. And if all you're going to get was some, you know, future junk, then it doesn't, maybe doesn't equalize.
That makes sense.
I mean, and I, you know, and I think that it's the kind of thing where his value to the Rockets for the rest of the season was much higher than his value to a team that might have to give up assets for him simply because he could walk. You know, why if as was reported, and you know he was not going to opt into his contract for next year. I mean, what would you give up for him? And if no one's going to give up anything for him, are you that desperate? I mean, you're still probably going to make the playoffs this year. Do you just punt on that now? And that in to some degree, that's a decision that's probably above Morey's head. So mm-hmm. I think it's complicated, and I can certainly understand why you don't just dump him.
That's fair. Speaking of guys that, you know, might not have value to the team the rest of the season, Ty Lawson reported buyout talks today. That is something that did not go very well.
No. Yeah, not at all. And I think this is much more about his decline as a player than anything else. I think that, you know, fine, he whatever his influence on the team, I seriously doubt that he was the straw that broke the camel's back in a healthy locker room, suddenly became toxic or something like that. I mean, if he could, you know, small point guard, not a great shooter, maybe as the quickness goes even just a little bit, the difference between, you know, getting by a guy and not, or getting a guy in your hip is the difference between being an effective player or not, and maybe he's lost that half a step that allows him to do that, and if that's not coming back, then he might be about done as a frontline player. And, you know, do you know that going in? No. So, you know, it didn't work out, and Houston did a good job of minimizing the risk, I think, from it. And, you know, they're going to be on the hook for the rest of this year and nothing next year.
Right, getting him to agree to make next year's salary non-guaranteed as part of the deal to trade for him was obviously the best part of that move.
That's, you know, considering what he's shown this year, that's just a mystifying decision in retrospect on his part.
Yeah, I mean, you would think if he was going to do that, he would have come in and, you know, I don't necessarily want to say been in as good a shape as possible. Like, I don't think he's not in shape. I think he's declined as a player. He's got some obvious personal issues that he's dealing with over the last couple of years. He was not necessarily a good on-court fit with the best player on the team. All of that said, though, I still think it makes sense as a worthy gamble, like to get him basically for free, to get him to again agree to non-guarantee the second year of his contract. And that's the kind of thing you take a risk on if you think you are, you know, one player away from true contention, which I think based on the way they played last year is something that they were justified in thinking. But, you know, that gamble did not work out, and several of their guys regressed in a big way this year. You know, Terrence Jones has been bad.
Pretty awful, especially defensively.
Mota Yunus has been in and out of the lineup because of injuries.
And on and off of the team because of injuries.
Right, on and off of the team because of injuries as well. Guys like Corey Brewer not playing nearly as well this year. You know, they got much better play from, like, Jason Terry last year.
Ariza's defense has slipped from last year.
Yes. Dwight, I don't think, is as good as he was last year either. Harden, obviously, was, at the beginning of the year, not as good. So, you know, it's a whole combination of things. It's not just Lawson. But
yeah, but also, I mean, the other point, I think the first point you brought up, which is a good one, is if they had just said, you know, okay, here's where Golden State is, here's where we are, run it back. Are you good enough? No, they weren't. I mean, I don't think that, like, if they had done nothing, so, okay, maybe so the avenue's open to them. You know, they played small ball. You know, they did low risk, possibly high reward, but low risk in terms of what they expended. Big risk in terms of the, I guess, the likelihood of it actually panning out. But still, you know, you took a shot and missed. It's probably a better move than doing nothing and just knowing that you're a cut below. Which, you know, objectively, I think that you would have had to say that coming into this year.
Oh, absolutely. That, you know, absolutely.
So, you know, it's a gamble that didn't work. Doesn't mean that you don't gamble in the future. And there was a little bit of the same thing. You know, the Rondo move for Dallas last year was the same thing. They knew they weren't good enough at the point guard to compete in the Western Conference playoffs. Now, you could argue that case, even more than this one, they paid too much for the gamble, and then it you know, blew up spectacularly. But
yeah, I mean, the Rockets paid nothing for Lawson, so it's not.
I mean, it's protected first.
I thought it was a second.
Yeah, I think it's a protected first that converts to a second if it doesn't go this year, I believe.
Let's see. The deal was, let's see.
tap dance.
Yeah. you can keep talking about whatever the issue you were talking about was.
The point is, it's just it's you know. Oftentimes we are very results oriented looking at these things. When if you look at it from the perspective of we would like to win a title, be a real contender, or whatever, we're not good enough now. We don't have the assets to necessarily go make a home run. We're definitely better move. So we have to take a risk on some small ball, and maybe it's a guy with injury risk, maybe it's a guy who's a head case, maybe it's a combination of both. You know, and if it doesn't work out, it doesn't mean we shouldn't have tried. Though, again, you can, especially in the Rondo deal, you can say, well, you paid too much for what upside there was in that gamble. But the fact of the gamble, I think, is probably laudable, because I think that's how we'd rather teams to behave, rather than just like, no, not our year, and sitting out.
Right, and it's, you know, it's recognizing where you are in the context of the league and in your development cycle. And I think that they rightly recognized where they were. The move just didn't work out. And it was Ty Lawson and a second-round pick for Houston's lottery-protected first, cash, and a bunch of nonsense.
Yeah. So, basically traded down, it's maybe certainly for what they've gotten, it's a win for Denver, but you know, that's being completely results oriented, and it could have easily, I don't want to say easily, but you can fairly easily envision a world in which it went the other way.
Yes. Was there anything that stood out for you other than Lillard and the six for twenty, whatever it was, performance that he had that stood out for you from Portland side in this one?
Just how effective Houston really got when they put length on Lillard and McCollum and packed the paint on everybody else, and that, you know, seemed to completely stymie Portland, and that's great story, but it kind of the Blazers this year, but that kind of a little bit shows that their ceiling, that kind of a simple adjustment like that is sort of all it took.
Yeah, to turn this game. And their defense collapsing in the second half too, I think. You know, they're more fun and surprising and surprisingly good than they are actually good.
Yeah.
Is basically where I
can. Yeah. And, you know, I think 10 out of 10 Blazer fans, people would take what they've gotten out of this season every single time, and they should. I've said it multiple times that Terry Stotts deserves some Coach of the Year recognition. Neil Olshey should be the front runner, as far as I'm concerned, for Executive of the Year. I mean, you talked about, you know, recognizing where you are as a franchise and then the life cycle, and all right, Aldridge is leaving. Here, let's pivot and do these other things. And it's have to like a lot of the moves they've made.
Almost all of their gambles have worked out.
Yeah, I think, you know, Mason Plumlee has been I think I don't know, better but good in different ways than you would have met it. Like his ability as kind of a playmaker and kind of ball handler on the perimeter and passer is something I certainly didn't expect. It may be in just something he never got to show in Brooklyn, but it's that certainly adds something to their attack. And then, you know, we had some fun with the Alfred Mucamino contract, which looks like a bargain now. Alan Crabb has developed.
We both liked that kind of a little bit. You know, thought it wasn't as bad.
Yeah.
As people were initially saying, it was obviously a bit of sticker shock.
Yeah.
But he's a good player, and he's played well. And, you know, there are other moves, I think. You know, they turned, you know, obviously Nick Batum has been playing very, very well for Charlotte this year, and I'm sure that Portland would still be happy to have him. But I think Vonleh has worked out fairly well for them. Henderson has been okay for them. You know, even that, which was probably their quote-unquote worst move of the offseason, has been okay. You know, Ed Davis has played pretty well. Mo Harkless has played well.
Yep.
McCollum and Crabb have turned into good players. Myers Leonard, you know,
has been Myers Leonard, it feels like.
Yeah, and even he, you know, he was hurt to start the year. You know, wasn't playing that well early on, was playing pretty well early on, then got hurt, then wasn't playing that well. Played well for a little bit, and then not playing as much. But even that, like him being a rotation player, is good. You know, it's a step up, I think, for most of their guys. And it's a good story. It's a surprisingly good team, but it's not yet an actually good team again.
And they also did, you know, smart things at the trade deadline. So to pick up a first and a second, I think, in various trades, to kind of use their unused, you know, the Memorial Enes Kanter salary cap room. They then turned into a first rounder and a second rounder for taking on Varejão's contract, and I forget the other one that they
Brian Roberts.
Yeah, they got a second for. So yeah, no, it's just a solid building year all around for Portland.
Absolutely.
Kind of last night's collapse notwithstanding.
Yes. I think that is a good place to end things for the day. You want to let people know what you got coming out writing-wise in the next few days or week or so?
Have had some interesting stuff coming out on Nylon Calculus this week. Looked into some historical shooting location stuff, the other piece was where players are getting their assists this year. And the other thing I looked at, which was pretty fun this week, was a breakdown of how often teams have been leading and how often they've been leading by 10 or more, 20 or more, or trailing by 10 or more, 20 or more. And comparing that to historically, unfortunately, the log files I was using only go back to 96, 97, so I couldn't compare this year's Warriors to the 95, 96 Bulls. But this year's Warriors have, you know, unsurprisingly have spent, you know, the most time of any team ever leading games, the most time leading by 10 or more, though actually San Antonio has spent more time this year leading by 20 or more.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I would imagine because Golden State's garbage time lineups and...
Yeah.
Have played more of the fourth quarter minutes and allowed leads to be cut.
I think that's probably accurate. But Golden State's games have also been this is not including last night's game, but about 53% of the minutes of their games do not feature one team or the other leading by 10 or more, which is. You know, and obviously the most of the 10-point lead is Golden State's. I think they've spent 40-some percent of all their time on the floor with at least a 10-point lead.
That's
which is
insane.
You know, yeah, which is, you know, the next highest since 96, 97 was the Celtics championship team, who were in around 33%. So just that kind of illustrates the degree to which they just jump on teams and stay ahead.
It's very games. Surprising to me that the 05-06 Knicks are not up there. I just gotta say.
Yeah, well, and the final funny note from that is the 2004-05 New Orleans Hornets spent from what best I can tell about 25 seconds all season with a lead of 20 points or more.
Okay.
I just thought I'd throw that out there just because that was, you know.
That's the year before they got Chris Paul?
I believe so, yeah. That was the year they were. That was a Byron Scott coach team.
Oh, tracker.
Anyway,
we will be back next week. First game next week, Spurs Pelicans. Second game next week, Thunder Warriors. So. Three
good
of the
times.
Four best teams in the league in action next week, plus Anthony Davis. Should be good times. You can follow Seth on Twitter, at Seth Partnow. Follow me, at JADugan5. Check out all of the other HP Basketball Network podcasts on Hardwood Paroxysm by clicking the link at the top of the screen for the podcast center. You can also check them out on Blog Talk Radio, on Stitcher, on iTunes. Seth, we'll talk to you next week, man.
Later on.